Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. It's number 435. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and as always, I'm joined by Mr. James Jones.
We just keep making them.
Yeah, Guillaume Veillette.
As always.
And taking place for Mr. Lindemann, who could not be with us this week,
is
our old friend, Seren McNulty.
Hey.
Hey, welcome. So this is Seren's first time appearing as a guest on a full episode, but you might have heard her on some of our past live shows, and you might know her from Twitter, where she spits a lot of hot game. And Seren actually is the developer of a game that we've talked about in the past, which was I've Got to Run.
And I've Got to Run Complete Edition.
Yes, good plug. Yes, that's the Wii U and the 3DS
now versions. Now available for 3DS eShop.
Yeah, now available in the North American Nintendo 3DS eShop for $4.99.
Yeah, it's a fun little game, I'll say. I played it. You gave us a copy, and it was a lot of fun. And Seren, you're also a game critic, right?
Yes. That is my full-time job.
So you are a full-time game critic, and you make games on the side. That seems like a dangerous combination.
It's time-consuming.
Yeah.
But also you ran into some trouble. I don't know if we want to talk about that, but there's a certain fit training thing. What's it called? Fit music on the Wii U?
Yeah. The gist was people weren't... There was one developer that wasn't too happy that I was doing both, but oh well.
Oh well.
Guillaume, you're trying to dig this up, but you won't let me talk about Santa Factory. Really?
We're not going to talk about either one, but we are going to talk about a lot of other games.
Awesome.
And we have listener mail coming up a little bit later in the show. I think we'll get through more of it than we did last week, and it maybe will be a little more constructive is what I'm hoping. That's going to be the theme for listener mail this week, is constructive. But first up is new business, and Seren, I had to get you to go first here. We might still take turns and come back around to, because you've got three huge games that I really, really, I think everybody will want to hear about.
I got more than that.
Because you play a lot of import stuff.
I speak Japanese, yes.
Yes. So you've got access to things that we don't often talk about here. And these are things I think people are going to care about. So can we please start off, and I'm mostly doing this for James's sake, but can we please start off with Xenoblade Chronicles X Cross?
Xenoblade Cross or Xenoblade Chronicles X, yes. So, where do I even begin? So, Xenoblade Chronicles X starts with you crashing onto a planet named Mira after, basically, Earth just gets caught in the crossfire in another war, and your planet gets blown up. But you're being sort of chased down for being a witness to that. They don't want any witnesses, so humans are kind of being hunted on this planet. You've set up one city called New Los Angeles, and the game starts, and you just go and explore these five different continents.
Now, a quick question about New Los Angeles, because I've seen this in a lot of the trailers, and it looks like a really cool setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that it's actually pretty big, it seems like. I mean, it's
very
like
big.
It's a believable city on this believable planet that the game takes place on. The scale of all this stuff is just massive. But is that the only city in the game? Is that really the only sort of sign of human or humanoid life? Or do you end up going on a, you know, Final Fantasy or Xenoblade style adventure where you're going to go from town to town and meet all these different races and stuff like that?
You will not go town to town, but as you're wandering around the continents, you will see humans with, like, drilling material trying to mine for materials, or you'll see other alien races, such as Ricky's race, the Nopon.
God damn it.
Yeah, they make an appearance. It's it's really fascinating, but that they decided that was the alien race that was going to return. So you go and you'll see some humans, and the game is passively online, which means if you set it to play online, there are some passive quests like collect 10 of this material or kill this one boss, and like endgame boss, and you, when you start the game, you join a squad, and you don't play with the people in that squad in your world, but if someone else in that squad defeats that monster or collects 8 of the material and you collect 2, then it gets checked off for the whole group. And as these quests get fulfilled, you'll all receive points. And so you will sometimes see AI players from your squad, AI versions of real character player characters, just wandering around, and you can have them join your party.
Wait, what? Okay. That's confusing to me. So AI versions of real character players. So are these like drivatars of people? I mean, are these like weird amiibo, you know, figure player type versions of people that that show up in your game, and they're supposed to behave like your friends do when they play the game?
They don't necessarily behave like them. They have the same setup, equipment, and class, so they have access to the same attack abilities.
Huh.
So keep in mind that because with the character creator, all your characters are going to look distinct, and you can set them up different ways, different stats and stuff, and build them differently. It's kind of like when... think of it a little bit like in Fire Emblem Awakening, where you could end up recruiting away the hero character from the people that you got in Spot Pass. You could end up hiring, so you could have like an entire party of hero characters.
Not quite in this game, but yeah, it's somewhat similar.
Yeah.
Because you have 3 permanent party members: yourself, Elma, and Lynn are going to be their English names, and then the 4th spot is in flux. That's rotating, so certain story missions might have someone tag along with you, or you can pick up other characters. And that actually takes me into the battle system, which is really fascinating because there are very few, if any, effective healing abilities. The way Whoa. the way that you heal is you listen to your party members, and sometimes they'll shout out, "Hey, do a side attack from the back." And so you'll run around its back and you'll do a side attack, and then by doing what your party members ask, your whole party gets a little health boost.
Hmm.
So
they're almost like little interactive cutscenes then, you know, like you're being prompted to... There was some of this in the last Xenoblade.
Yes, but it's taken up to 11. In Japanese, I don't know what it's called in English, but in Japanese it's called the Soul Voice System.
Mm-hmm.
And you are just sort of making sure that all of your actions are beneficial to the group. And you can do the same thing. You can hit a button, the plus button, and it'll just you'll just get this sort of text menu of things that you can call out to your allies to get them to go do what you want.
Oh, okay. You can send commands. Because that was... You couldn't do that much in Xenoblade. Like, when you used one of those combo attacks, I forget what they're called, but...
Break and topple, know, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, when you get when your meter fills up or whatever, and mm-hmm. you get an opportunity to sort of freeze time and you input a command for each character, it's the one time in Xenoblade where it almost becomes turn-based, because you can actually set up a combo, you know, by ordering all of your different people to do something in tandem, you know, and that was it was kind of rare that you got to do that, you know, otherwise you were always playing as Shulk. So it sounds like you have more direct control over your other characters in this game, because you can just give them commands whenever?
You're not giving them commands like, use this specific art. You're giving them commands like, everyone fall back and attack it from the rear. Or,
okay, yeah, I need some quest style
boost. You know, yeah, or like, I need some buffs. Make sure that he's poisoned,
mm-hmm.
Etc. And yeah. By doing that, it actually makes it feel like a really social game, even though it's a single-player game. It's a single-player, huge RPG. And there are many, many different classes. There's this big class tree, like skill tree, and as you level up a class to like level 10, which is its max for the player character, you can move on to another class and another class, and those classes use different weapons and different arts. And so you'll equip and train up different arts and different weapons, and you'll forge more onto the weapons.
And arts are like magic, if you haven't played magic. Yes. or like sword techniques.
Yep,
you know,
abilities.
That kind of thing. They're basically special moves that you can do that are very important, and you have a lot of them, and they have a lot of different effects. But anyway, we talked a lot about mechanics, and I appreciate all the information, Soren, but I'm really curious what you think of the game. I mean, did you finish it, and how do you think it compares to the first Xenoblade?
I was real close to finishing it. There are 12 story missions in the game.
Only 12?
Yes and no. So the missions, some are short and some are very, very long, but you can't just go story mission to story mission. Not only will you just get your ass kicked, but also the game just won't let you. You have to fulfill requirements such as you have to have explored this much of this continent and laid down this many data mines. You have to do this side quest. The bulk of the game is accepting side quests and exploring and charting out this world. Because if you've seen the gamepad map, which is just a sort of hexagonal map of all the continents, every single hexagon has some challenge associated with it, whether it's lay a data mine or defeat this huge level 65 creature or collect this rare material. But when you complete it, that's when you unlock your fast travel point.
Yeah, I've heard about this on Famicast because those guys have been playing it, and it's like explore the world, the game. Go find all the secrets in this amazing naturalistic looking world, the game. I mean, it sounds heavenly. It sounds incredible to me. So you like it?
I love it. The soundtrack changes with the time of day, just like the last game. And so when you're looking out off a mountaintop and it's sunset, and then the sun sets, and then just this sort of acoustic guitar music plays as it starts to become nighttime, and the stars start coming out, and you're just running along. It's just this most magical experience. It's my favorite Wii U game. It is incredible.
Awesome. I'm pretty upset about having to wait until December to play it, but it sounds like it'll be worth the wait.
Yeah, it sounds very much like it evokes the same feelings as the first Xenoblade, except now, you know, prettier.
Way bigger world.
But, and it's less of a story-heavy game, too, right?
Yes, there is a story. The story has twists and turns, as you would expect if you've played and finished Xenoblade Chronicles.
Or any game they've made ever, really.
It gets real, real hectic. I will give you a word of warning, though, and I think this has been echoed on the Famicast, but I need to reiterate this. If you are playing this game because you want a mech game, you do not get the mechs for the first 50 hours of the game.
Yeah.
You get them at the end of Story Mission 6, and then there's about 10 or 12 side quests that you need to complete that are really long before you can get your driver's license, and even then, your mech can't fly, it can only walk around.
Your mech learner's permit.
I bet, Soren, when you finally get it all the way built and licensed...
It's unbelievable.
...and flying, I bet it's the greatest feeling because you earned it. Like, it's a process that you go through.
It is a rigorous process. It just becomes amazing, and these mountains that you had to either try and sort of cheat the physics of the game to jump across, like to climb up the little ridges, or that you had to take long circuitous paths around to climb up a mountain and cross a land bridge, you can just cover that in about 3 seconds. And it's just comparing where you were to where you end up is just this huge, hugely satisfying progression. I cannot recommend this game enough.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, that sounds totally analogous to the, you know, like finding the airship in the original Final Fantasy, which happens like 3/4 of the way through the game. And all of a sudden, you can get to all these places you could never, you know, you saw, but you could never get to. It's really exciting. It feels like you really have command of the world. And it's okay that it happens late in the game because you kind of know it's coming. It's in all the artwork and the marketing and everything. Like, it's not a secret or anything. but it's kind of a carrot that keeps motivating you to get going, you know, deeper and deeper into the game, because you want to really get to that point and feel that the freedom, you know, and Final Fantasy as a series has usually been very good about it, not recently, but that was always one of my favorite things about those games. So hearing that, you know, the new Xenoblade follows a similar formula, and it sounds like it really accentuates and formalizes the parts of the game that I love the most. I know James also was a huge fan of just wandering off in a direction and exploring and getting experience points, even when you find really cool new places, you know, and unlocking all these crazy achievements that actually, you know, give you more experience. It's like the game is rewarding you for doing the thing that you just naturally want to do anyway, which is go out there and look around every little detail of this beautiful place that they've imagined for us. So I'm super excited for it.
There's something that I really hope they don't translate from Japanese to English, which is you'll get experience points for looking out at vistas and finding like amazing viewpoints. And as you do, you get a ton of experience, and the massive words on screen just appear that say "discovery of a superb view." And I really hope that doesn't change, because that's such a defining moment in the game, even just being able to go out there and do that. And to what you were saying about how the mechs aren't a secret, they dangle that carrot in front of you constantly. You're walking around New Los Angeles, people are walking around in their mechs. The first mission in the game, and this isn't a spoiler because they showed it off at E3 2014, is you wander out and you find a crashed Skell in English, doll in Japanese, and you're trying to find the rider and help save them.
Okay, so the mechs aren't like a big secret, they're just part of the world.
Yep, first thing you see, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, in that trailer where they're entering New Los Angeles, I think one flies overhead, doesn't it? Like very early.
So it's part of the society that you're sort of, you know, help trying to save, and that sounds awesome. I mean, even the fact that you have to get a license for it, it tells you a lot about the kind of infrastructure that these people have, and...
Oh, yeah.
They're not going to hand you the keys to their salvation just because they found you. Like, oh, hey, here you go. Here's the super expensive thing.
You're not the chosen one. You come in as a rookie recruit, and you have to, like, work your way and, like, develop trust with the commanders and captains of the military group called Blade. You have to, basically the first mission is, hey, kid, why don't you go out and pick some flowers? Just like, why don't you go make yourself useful? And then as you do, of course, you run into an enemy and you take it down, and then they look at you and they're like, well, maybe you're worth training.
Yeah.
But it is not a you're the chosen one sort of scenario.
All of this sounds fantastic to me. I'm really glad to hear it, Seren. Thank you for enlightening us a little bit.
Do any of you have any other questions?
I just want it to come out. Just yep. Can you make it come out faster? Because that's what I need. No, that's it. But let's come back to Seren a little bit later. I think we will have time. We're going to make time because there's more good stuff.
Mine'll be quick. The average age of my games is like 20. So whatever.
We'll go, James.
I talked last week about trying to drain my Club Nintendo coins, and Nintendo actually making that impossible briefly, and I ended up with basically every Mario game you could get in Club Nintendo, which has been kind of an interesting experience. So we did Super Mario World for a retroactive, I don't know, a long time ago, to the point where I asked some of the people on this show about 2 months ago, hey, did we ever do a retroactive for Super Mario World? And I don't actually remember that retroactive at all, which is fun. Like my recollection of playing that game really goes back to when I was a little kid playing it at my cousin's house. So I hadn't played that in a while. But I also grabbed Mario 3 and Yoshi Island at the same time, which is the Mario Advance 3, which is...
Right, the GBA version with a smaller screen real estate. And
yeah, and...
And that's then, Yoshi's old island.
Yes, yes, Yoshi's old busted island, which is then... up-res to a TV, which just, I don't understand why they did that, not the Super Nintendo version, but whatever.
Because it has the Super FX chip.
Oh, that's true. And then there's that, but that means that there's all that multiplayer stuff I can't play, which is cool.
Yep.
But, so I got that, and I've actually done this weird little thing where I found myself just bouncing between them, kind of, I'd play a level of one, go, alright, and then end up, not deliberately, rotating, but just sort of doing it because these games are almost disposable in the way that I got them. And it's a very interesting process to see how all three of these games sort of evolved, you know, sequentially, because they are essentially, you know, World is very much built on three, and then Yoshi's Island is I mean, they did kind of refer to it as the sequel to Mario World, didn't they?
Well, North America, but...
But, I mean, it isn't. It is and it isn't. Yoshi's in it. I guess that makes it kind of a sequel. But I actually... This is my first time playing Yoshi's Island, and I actually really enjoyed that quite a lot. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. It's very kind of... It's a very... I mean, first off, if you've played a Yoshi game ever, you sort of played this game, because a lot of pretty much every Yoshi game that's come out is sort of heavily based on this game. Everything from
They all use these mechanics. They all
a wholesale copy, which is kind of what's so jarring about playing these three, is because these three games came out. I knew this earlier. 6 or 7 years total between them all. Maybe not even that much, and they're all fairly vastly different. Mario 3 and World obviously have a lot of commonality, but they still play very differently, especially when you're playing them back to back and you see those differences. So it's kind of surprising that, you know, we are sitting on the advent of a Yoshi release, or if you're in Europe, I guess it's already out. Is that game, for all its physical characteristics, all its, you know, presentational stuff, is still essentially very much a similar game to what I just played. Even down to like how things like transformations are leveled. The only real difference is, I mean, how exploration is handled is slightly differently in Yoshi's Epic Yarn, as I've referred to it occasionally. The game is, you know, it's predicated on hiding stuff in plain sight, whereas Yoshi's Island, it's much more about you can see something, but there's no clear way to get there. It's not like, oh, you have to be clever and pull that piece of thing off and look behind it. It's more of, how do I get up there, you know, using the level? It's much more about kind of the maze structure of the levels than the upcoming Yoshi's Woolly World. But mechanically, it's the same game. So I'm a little surprised that these games have become so, I don't want to say frozen, but have become so static in their evolution from a gameplay mechanics.
Yeah.
When compared to these three. Now, at the same time, I understand Nintendo did not make a 2D Mario game for about 15 years. They basically went from Yoshi's Island all the way to New Super Mario Bros. On the DS. So that's a fairly long time between games. So they may not have felt that there was a significant need to iterate, that it had been so long that the sheer going back to it served as your iteration. But it would be nice to see some degree of the experimentation that you see kind of play out in all three of those games. Because for reference, I went and played Mario 2, which I also got, which of course is a whole different thing. It is Doki Doki Panic. And then I've played Mario Lost Levels fairly recently, which is just the original Mario game, but basically built around the idea of using the game glitching bugs in the first game to beat it. And you know, in that period, there was a lot of quick iteration, but now it does seem very static. And I know we talk about this when we say, like, you know, there's whether or not we feel like Nintendo iterates and Nintendo tries new things. But Yoshi, I mean, just how much controlling Yoshi is changed from Yoshi Island, from Super Mario World. Things like, I mean, Yoshi, the eggs, the flutter jump, it's a much more full-featured, you know, gameplay mechanic, which of course it had to be because that's who you're controlling. It is a little bit of a bummer that we haven't seen, you know, some kind of change like that. But it's more than just, you know, adding new suits.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what they're doing. Like, R-Toon has been in charge of the Yoshi's Island games, the sequels anyway. So the Yoshi's Island DS, they had this whole mechanic of switching babies on Yoshi's back. And that would make Yoshi have slightly different powers. Like, if you had Donkey Kong, then your eggs wouldn't bounce, they would explode. And you needed that to cross certain passages or certain obstacles and things like that. And but R-Toon, I think, really...
R-Toon's not a great developer. I mean, I don't think they ever made one fantastic game.
No, and their games, and like Yoshi's Island DS and Yoshi's New Island, which I played recently, they're both kind of designed on kind of like a gacha kind of level design. Like they both like, okay, so you've got this boulder that you're pushing around, you're killing enemies, and then you push it into an incline that you're not going to get it back from, and it's like, ah, gotcha. Like, you were supposed to kind of stop right before it would have fallen to this hole, and then you would have climbed on it, and there was like this hidden ceiling basically you could jump to. Like things like that, like just kind of like really asshole-y moments where if you're trying to complete the level 100% the first time, which was perfectly reasonable to expect in the first game on the Super Nintendo, you'd just be frustrated. So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of Artoon or Artek or...
Wasn't their first Yoshi game Topsy-Turvy, a.k.a. Universal Gravitation?
Oh, is that them too?
I don't think that was their first one. That was like a late-era GBA.
I think that's their first Yoshi
game.
Wasn't
that Touch and Go, though? Wasn't their first game Touch and Go?
I want to say they worked on Topsy-Turvy.
Maybe so, but it doesn't matter. Those are all bad games, and
they are.
We don't need to talk about them anymore because... I mean, Yoshi's Woolly World is coming. I don't know why it's taking... Well, I think I do know why it's taking until October. It's because...
They told us.
Europeans right now are playing it. Right now, Greg, I'm sure, is playing it.
I'm positive that Greg got that at the earliest possible moment. Because he's a massive Yoshi fan, and he's been waiting for a true successor of Yoshi's Island for a very long time. And I think Yoshi's Woolly World, to me... seems close enough. Like it's close enough in quality, and it has enough new ideas that are actually good and not just new for the sake of being new, like, you know, carrying Donkey Kong on your back instead of Baby Mario. I mean, who cares?
Baby Donkey Kong, thank you.
Yeah, Goodfeel is just a much better developer. They made a Wario Land game, they knocked it out of the park. Kirby's Epic Yarn has like weird design decisions in my opinion, but it's still a very well done game. And everything I've heard says that Woolly World is excellent.
And it's been in development for a long time. So I mean, they've really taken their time to polish it and get it balanced just right. And I think they want this to be the one finally that actually kind of, you know, makes Yoshi feel like a good series again, you know, a good platforming franchise. Mm-hmm.
The one thing I'm hopeful about for this game is that they finally given you the option to change that, in my opinion, awful egg throwing mechanic where you completely stop, wait for the cursor to go up and down and have to time it right, because you can just use the Wiimote sideways and use motion tilt control to aim, which seems like it would be a lot more fluid, and it's the first evolution towards that, which makes me think that maybe, just maybe, they'll start making Yoshi games that don't have that egg-throwing mechanic. Because that was a limitation of not having any analog control.
Yeah.
Right.
It is actually weird sometimes to play it when the game expects you to do something somewhat quickly. Not for the... For the most part, in Yoshi's Island, they seem to be aware of that limitation, that there's no fast way to do that. And in fact, the game tutorializes you multiple times about, hey, if you press the R trigger, it'll stop moving. And you can still walk around. So then you can get it set up and then walk to where it needs to be. But the fact that they felt like they had to keep telling you that tells me during playtesting, people got really irritated with it.
Yeah, it's probable.
I spoke a lot about, you know, Yoshi's Island. Super Mario World, of course, is an amazing game. I'm a bit surprised by its difficulty and 3's difficulty. I'm not going to go here and John and just slam this game for being too hard. It's not in that sense of when people talk about, oh, games are so much harder when I was a kid. It's just how difficulty manifests itself is different. There was not the conscious decision to ramp up difficulty. I'm deep into World at this point, and I'm fairly certain that with the exception of maybe the star levels, which I haven't really gotten into, there's probably nothing, you know, as just purely difficult as some of the last secret stages in like New Super Mario Brothers. I think 2 had the really weird.
Well, it had that crazy DLC, and then, you know, like New Super Luigi Brother or New Super Luigi U. Yeah. Luigi. Luigi.
Luigi
U. That game's real hard in the best way.
But there's things like the crown stages in, you know, Super Mario 3D Land that are just nightmare fuel. And
yeah, my world is I'm sure we talked about this a lot on the Retroactive, which I also don't remember well, but luckily there's a there's a recording for us to enjoy for all time.
You can go listen.
Yeah, indeed. It still exists. It's on the internet, so it'll never die. It's an easy game overall, especially compared to 3. And most of the difficult stuff is in the star levels, even though most of those are gimmicky and have kind of a trick you can do to make them super easy. But if you try to play through it normally, it can be very difficult or impossible. Actually impossible, because you have to find the secret exits to even proceed. And the special world is, you know, balls to the wall crazy.
A lot of what makes those games hard, three stages are actually super short in general. And that was one of the things when I walked away from, like, wow, these stages are really short. Like, clearing some stages in, you know, sub 2 minutes, just because you...
And remember, 3 didn't have checkpoints. So in World, the levels are so much longer than any of the previous games that they added for the first time those checkpoints.
A lot of times what's difficult in those games is, you know, maybe it's just because you're rocketing through the stage, there's something that just hits you. It's not like how they handle difficulty now, which is to layer complexity on top of the stage. A lot of times now when these games get really hard, and because it scales the difficulty so much more slowly and evenly, when they get really hard, it's not because they're hitting you with something really just that seems arbitrary. It's not like a Sonic death where it's just like you gotta go fast, and then suddenly, hey, spike wall, and you slam into it. It's much more like you may even have a chance to stop and kind of mentally process through what you're trying to do. It's because the game's asking you to do more at this point. It's not just hitting you with things more. So the difficulty feels, it scales better. So I think perception of difficulty is shifted. Super Mario World, I mean, they start dispensing with some of that kind of shitty, like, hey, here's an enemy that's going to get you as soon as you come through the corner pretty early. Like, they start giving that to you, you know, probably in Donut Plains. I mean, like, you're going down the steps and then all of a sudden there's an enemy you can't kill, with the one with the spikes on its back. You're like, oh, well, great. I have to jump over this thing, and I landed on the one after it. Okay. But in the more modern games, you know, it's because the platforming tends to be more of the challenge, less so than the enemies. It forces you to sort of learn these mechanics much more thoroughly and understand what you can do with them. When we go back, when we're talking about Donkey Kong 94 last week, and we talked about how there's all these jump mechanics that ultimately aren't particularly important, but having them makes things easier. Now with these games, it's more you need to have those mechanics, you know, you need to understand those mechanics well or you can't clear the stages. And how the game asks you to use them is really where the difficulty comes in. There's a level in Mario 3D Land, one of the very late levels, and it's built like the stages that you don't have flood during the in the Sunshine, where it's just big platform or narrow platforms in open space. And there's a series of wall jumps you have to do while going forward to get up to the next level of platforms, and you're being chased by the dark, you know, the ink blot Mario. That stage is really, really insidious, but you have to understand, A, how Mario, the dark Mario moves, i.e. follows your pattern, and B, how to wall jump quickly. You know, get him off your tail for a second and then execute the wall jump. It's not just like, hey, you're gonna get hit by a lot of crap because that's what this game does. It's more the difficulty from the mechanics, and because it scales and because it's so much based on what you've learned, I think that makes those games appear less difficult than they are because you're just better prepared.
Yeah, that's interesting, James, and I agree with you. And I think one reason that people do like 3D Land and 3D World so much is that so much more than the new Super Mario Brothers series, they really are demanding, and they ask you to learn how to do several things that may be unique to that particular game in the series. And then do them all in combination with the things that you can always do in Mario and with each other, you know. And I remember even the last couple times I played 3D World with other people, we would just jump to a random stage. Or I was playing with someone at E3. It might have been TYP. I can't remember now. But I was playing with someone, and they were still trying to get all the, you know, the gold flag poles or whatever, you know, just kind of marking things off the list just to get towards 100% completion. And so we just went to some kind of, you know, fairly advanced level, fairly late in the game. I didn't remember it in particular. And, you know, I've beaten it before. I've played basically that entire game. But playing through it again, sort of out of context, I was struck at just like how precise you needed to be with your angles and with your, you know, your 3D jumping and your depth perception, how, you know, I was trying to factor in the extra flutter I could get from a raccoon tail, but also I was, you know, trying to coordinate with the other player to make sure that they got their fireballs thrown at the piranha plant that comes out in the spiky pipe patterns, you know, and right. We're going from island to island. And if we fall off the island, then you're in the poison and you die immediately. And there's also like cannons shooting bullet bills and fireballs at you. And there's also secrets over here that are distracting you, even though you should probably ignore them. I mean, I was really struck by just how complicated these situations were that they had constructed for us to get through. I was like, as an obstacle course, this is perfect. I mean, if I really want something that's going to test my ability to process all this and to do complex kinds of things, I mean, it really feels like a dexterity test and a patience test. And you feel like this is Nintendo demanding a lot from the player.
But the thing is, I bet when you played that stage the first time, you were probably less conscious of how insane that stage was.
Because I'd encountered all these elements on their own and in lesser combinations. Yeah, I mean, and this was a fairly advanced level in the game. It might be even in a secret world. And if you're a bad player, you might go through the game and not even know that you're missing this stuff, you know, potentially. Because Nintendo's pretty good at not taunting you too much with things that you're not skilled enough to do. You notice that? They tend to hide that stuff in a way that you kind of have to be in the know. You got to be on the message boards or listening to the podcasts, or you have to be really thorough and like actually looking to, you know, kind of complete everything and get the most out of it. And in like 3D World in particular, hell, half the game is hidden, you know? I mean, 3D Land as well, because it has all those remixes of the levels that are way more fun, way more interesting to play through. But you don't even unlock that stuff until you beat the game the first time. In 3D World, they're not even the same levels remixed. They're completely new worlds that have some of the best content in the whole game. And you might not even know that it's there if you don't play the main part of it really thoroughly. So Nintendo, you know, I think these are good examples of Nintendo still making games that are challenging and expect a lot of you and figure that you're pretty darn good at video games. Or, you know, there's stuff in there. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in there for the people who really know what they're doing. And that's nice. You know, it's a nod to those of us who've been playing Mario games for like 30 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel like it punishes people who are playing it for the first time.
I just wanted to say, I was looking it up while you were talking. If anyone wants to find the retroactive, it's split between episodes 158 and 159.
God, that was like 5 years ago.
It's a very long time ago. Yeah.
Yep. This is what, 435?
It is. Yep. So we're going to now flip over to Guillaume. We've heard amazing things about Xenoblade. We've had a very positive discussion about Mario and Yoshi. Guillaume, can you keep that happy train rolling?
No, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm going to be the negative person. Well, it's not super... Like, I don't think that anyone is going to be crushed that I didn't like Soul Hackers. Shin Megami Tensei Soul Hackers. Because, I think the people who are interested in playing it already have, or will, no matter what I say. And the people who are like, what the hell is a Shin Megami Tensei? Like, they're just not, they've already skipped forward.
Well, perhaps they would like to hear it as Gen Ibun Roku, Sharp FE.
Right. No, we're not gonna delve into that again.
We're gonna save that for when that game gets closer.
No, but like to make a short story short, really. I tried to get into Soul Hackers. I became a kind of a, you know, a fan of that universe with Persona 4. I thought it was a great entry point. I thought the game did a good job explaining its systems, explaining how the world. That world works, you know, like summoning demons and that stuff. And it has lots of niceties, like, you know, being able to see at any point what the weaknesses or the strong points of demons are. So, you know, like you encounter a demon, you try, you know, a fire attack, and then it's kind of recorded forever that you've tried a fire attack and it did extra damage or it was not effective, or it was just a standard, you know, attack. And so, you know, like you can keep trying different things on that daemon. And again, those results are going to be recorded and you can bring them up. And at any time, you just hold like one of the shoulder buttons. And, you know, like despite their names, despite their incomprehensible titles, I think the modern Shin Megami Tensei games are pretty user-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that I managed to get into, and I think that there's something that most RPG fans would be able to get into. Soul Hackers, however, is the first time that we've got this game over here in North America. It hadn't left Japan. It was a Sega Saturn game. Cause and effect there. That's the reason why we never got it. So for the first time they've translated it, and as far as I can tell, I think they've added a lot. They've actually added some things, like some hacks, quote unquote, that's what they call them. They're kind of like cheats. You can turn on and off certain things that were not in the original version that make the game a little bit easier. So it's nice that they did that. It's nice that you've got the map of an area being filled out automatically as you're exploring in first person. It is a kind of a dungeon crawler in first person. It's kind of like in Etrian Odyssey, except that you don't draw the map yourself.
Or Fester's Quest.
Sure.
That was a staple of a lot of the old SMT games before the PS2 era, even.
Right. I think that Shin Megami Tensei 4 was the first one that had the third-person view, or did Nocturne as well have...
Nocturne was third-person.
Oh, okay. All right. But yeah, so, you know, very old-school, some niceties, but it does not have the, as far as I could tell, the kind of recording the weakness of a demon. And demons, you know, they're not just there... they're not just there for you to kill... They're also there for you to try to recruit. You always have in combat the option to talk to the demons and try to, I don't know, to get along with them or to answer. Like sometimes they're going to ask you a question like, oh, I'm really hungry. I love eating humans. What part of you is the best? And you can answer like, oh, the tongue, the arm, or I taste horrible. And I don't know. I don't understand how it works. I don't understand exactly how you're supposed to know what the demons it wants to hear. And not only that, but you can see at the top of the screen the phases of the moon in game. Apparently it takes you months to explore a hangar. It doesn't really make any sense, but anyway. So you see the phases of the moon, and that affects demon behavior as well.
I mean, this is all like classic Shin Megami Tensei as far as I know.
Yeah, this all sounds...
This isn't new to Soul Hackers. This is pretty old school stuff for this
franchise. It might be old school stuff, but it was not in Persona. It was not in Shin Megami Tensei 4. I think those games, the more modern games, are much more welcoming, are much more streamlined, and just easier to get into in general.
I mean, Guillaume, you could tell me that the phases of the moon move in real time, and I would believe it when we're talking this era of SMT. But yeah, of course, why wouldn't they do that?
Sure. Yeah, right.
The thing about Shin Megami Tensei, and I've only been laughing because I'm a huge fan of the series, and I understand everything you're saying perfectly, is that right around PS2 era, I think just around Nocturne, maybe a little after it, they really started trying to make them have more broad appeal. And so with games like Digital Devil Saga and Persona 3 and Persona 4 and Shin Megami Tensei 4, they've been pushing very, very heavily to make it user-friendly and make it easy to jump into and understand. But the dialogue in Soul Hackers, for instance, the way that I originally figured that out when I played it for the first time was I opened up a spreadsheet in Excel and I started making notes.
Oh God. Yeah, I'm playing on the 3DS. I was trying to get a nice mobile RPG to play on vacation, you know? So it doesn't really work.
No, you can take notes on the 3DS. It's on the home screen.
So. Oh, it's not super convenient.
Didn't they move all the really crazy obscure stuff to spin off things like Raido Kuzunoha? I mean, your Soul Hackers is kind of on the fringe here, I guess.
It is. Yeah. It's not a numbered SMT game, and the numbered SMT games try to be the more mainstream ones, as well as the Persona and Devil Summoner or Devil Survivor.
So I guess it's more than Sega, the Sega Saturn being why this game didn't come out.
Yeah.
No, but it's like the most Saturn game ever. You know,
yep.
Right.
It's like it's so Japanese and it's so hardcore. And it, yeah, I mean, if I was Sega of America back then, you know, I would have taken one look at this and said, that ain't coming out here. You know, give me a break. They couldn't even release like the good, easy to play games out in America, much less stuff like Soul Hackers. It had no chance whatsoever.
Guillaume, this is where you edit in the Sonic R music. Everybody, Sonic Racing.
So I've actually got, you know, like kind of a backlog. I don't know why I did that to myself. I've got a backlog of Shin Megami Tensei games to play. So it was very easy to put this one on the side and just be like, okay, I can't see myself really enjoying it ever, you know, because the no, but seriously, like I don't think it's really going up from here. Like I'm still only at the beginning, but I'm exploring hangars and just trying to. There's not the environments are not really interesting. The thing that appeals to me the most is the cutscenes because they're so old. They're so 90s, you know, like the first time that you see the shops, there's a cutscene that plays CG cutscene. I'm sure it was very expensive to animate. And it's this spiral staircase that pops out of the ground one step at a time, you know. It's like something out of Myst.
I was going to say, it sounds like one of those weird little videos, like tiny QuickTime videos in the corner of Myst.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it looks grainy and it looks like it.
Oh. Sega Saturn, I love you.
Dude, I'm going to have to look these up on YouTube because I love stuff like that.
But it's like it was like the eye candy of the day, right? And
right,
like we
right.
would see that staircase and we would watch it because it looked so cool. Like that's what the 90s were like.
And to me now, it almost has like an old claymation kind of appeal. You know,
yeah.
Like one of those, what's the guy's name that did all the effects for Clash of the Titans? Harryhausen. Ray
yes.
Harryhausen.
Uh-huh.
It almost has that kind of appeal to it because it's like this was so exotic and advanced in its time and it still looks... Mm-hmm. Like, weird and cool and antiquated all at the same time. I love stuff like that.
I do want to correct one thing, and that is, Guillaume, don't you ever imply the Sega Saturn did anything well. Ever.
Okay.
On this
I'm
show.
I'm sorry.
Guy.
Yep.
I can tell you right now, you're safe putting that aside. You're not going to like it.
Yeah.
I, as someone who has achieved about 96% completion of the compendium in that game, you're not going to like that game.
Yeah.
I would ask though, like you at least got it when it was on one of its Atlas non-flash sales, right?
Yeah, no, I did. Like it was $15. It seemed like a
okay.
good price, and
yes.
I got other Atlas RPGs for $15 that I can move on to. So I'm set. I'm good.
Wait for another month, and I think it's about time for Devil Survivor 2 Break Record to enter that sale routine.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, but I've got plenty to play even before then, so I'm good.
Well, speaking of plenty to play, I've got probably literally hundreds of games that I wish I could be playing lately, and I haven't had time. It's been a wonderful month with E3 and a couple other trips following immediately after that, but it's been incredibly busy, and it's gotten to the point where I think this is maybe the least gaming I've had over the past 6 or 8 weeks since I studied abroad in Russia, and that was back in 2003. So it's, I mean, and that's because I only took my GBA with me. It was the GBA SP, and I didn't have a universal adapter to charge to use the charger. So I would borrow it from a friend every now and then. And then when he left after the first month I was there, he sold it to me for like $10 American. And so then I was able to charge it after that, and I played a bunch of Advance Wars and Aria of Sorrow. And that was probably the least video games I've played over a long stretch since now. So it's been a dry summer for me. I've had so many games just staring at me, and I want to play them so bad, and I just cannot right now. But starting tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday and this weekend, I'm excited. It's my first free weekend in over a month, and I get to play a lot of video games, and I'm so excited. I miss them. One game. I apologize for my quality of new business lately, because it's been really pathetic. And it's even worse coming out of E3, because I always tell people, although it may seem surprising, when you come out of E3, you really want to play video games. Like, it gets you pumped up for them, but the way games are presented at E3 in trailers and like very short, you know, 10-minute demos, 15 minutes, is you don't really get the satisfaction that you have come to expect from video games. Like, you get the excitement of what they can potentially be, and you see a lot of them, but you don't really get to play them. And so after a whole week of E3, it's all just teases. It's like if you spent 3 days just watching movie trailers, you know, at the end of it, you'd be like, I'd really like to sit down and just watch a whole movie now, please. And that's exactly how I feel about video games coming out of E3. And yet I felt that way for now about 3 weeks, because I still haven't had time to sit down and play one. I have very occasionally and sporadically, for like 10 minutes at a time, played a game that I'll talk about briefly here called Roundabout. And Roundabout is an incredibly weird game and very funny and hard to even explain. But the reason I want to talk about it is because it is very much related to a game that we've probably almost never mentioned on this podcast. By the time we started doing RFN, it wasn't much of a factor anymore, and it never was really in America, but that is Kuru Kuru Kururin, the bizarre Japanese action puzzle game.
Right.
From Aiting, of all people.
From Aiting. Oh, man, I forgot about that. Creators of Bloody Roar, Primal Fury.
That's right.
James' yep. favorite fighting game ever.
I never said that. Holy shit.
It is, though. You're a master at it. You're so good. You whip it up with that bunny.
This is your new legacy.
Yeah. Kuru Kuru Kururin was a very big favorite among some of the old Planet GameCube staff who were getting into the import scene in the early 2000s, because the original one came out for GBA and was never released in the West at all. I don't even think that one came out in Europe. Maybe it did. I know the sequel did come out in Europe, but still not North America. And there was a apparently very good GameCube version with a lot of cool new modes and different features and stuff and much better graphics. And that also never came out of Japan. I think maybe in Europe. It was one of those weird cases back then when Europe got something and America didn't.
You mean right now?
None of the games ever came out in America, and so I'm afraid a lot of our audience won't have it as a reference point, but maybe it actually works in Roundabout's favor, because you'd have to have a pretty weird, deep lore of Nintendo Japanese stuff to even realize that Roundabout is like a wholesale ripoff of this game, but it's a very good ripoff. It's a lot of fun, and it captures the spirit. But the idea is that you're looking kind of from a top-down or bird's-eye perspective on this field. And the character, or in this case, the vehicle and Roundabout that you're controlling, is spinning 360 degrees. In Kuru Kuru Kururin, it was a character with a helicopter hat, or someone driving a helicopter, I don't even remember. But you have the spinning blades, and you can't let them touch anything. So you have to you're moving this character around just, you know, up, down, left, right, like real basic cardinal directions, diagonal, whatever. But you can't touch anything, and this thing, not only is it like, you know, navigate through these mazes and don't touch the walls, it's you have to do that while your character is huge and has these wild arms that are swinging out, basically, and you're you're spinning around in a big circle, and so it comes down to timing. You have to not only move very carefully through all these obstacles, but you have to time it just right and kind of use the spin to bend your way through a lot of very tight spaces and around a lot of crazy looking obstacles. So that was Kuru Kuru Kururin, and of course in that game you were timed a lot, if I recall. In Roundabout, you're not. And that's one way in which I think it's much better. But it is basically the same idea. You're a cab driver. It looks kind of like a weird demake of Crazy Taxi at first. And it is inspired somewhat by Crazy Taxi.
Hey!
It plays very differently because it plays like Kuru Kuru Kururin. So your giant limousine is spinning in 360 degrees for the entire game. You can never stop it. You can sometimes change direction if you hit bouncy rubber canisters. You can make it change direction of rotation, but it's always spinning. And not only that, but Roundabout is a series of challenges and little pathways that you have to take and stuff like that. But it's laid out in this open world map kind of thing. So you have to actually navigate from challenge to challenge and save points. And you can buy properties like Grand Theft Auto style for some reason on this weird map that they've set up. And so even sometimes getting from one place to the next just to go, you know, try to repair your car at the shop or go buy a house or something can be extremely difficult. And then once you start a mission, you see these bizarre full motion video cutscenes that make no sense at all. Those missions then are like the meat of the game, and they're still really challenging and really crazy sometimes what they ask you to do. And they're a lot of fun. The game succeeds because it's very funny. It has a weird sense of humor for sure. And it makes the most out of its almost non-existent production values. And also it's not brutal. Like, it's set up to be very challenging, and you look at a lot of things and you think that's impossible. There's just no way over it. But it encourages you to just throw yourself into it, try to find a way to maneuver your crazy car around all this stuff, because there's lots of checkpoints. They're very, very frequent. There's no penalty for blowing up and just trying again. It's a very easygoing game. It reminds me of like some of the best things about Katamari Damacy, a lot of other like really weird indie games that normally you wouldn't expect to get off of Steam, but Sony's been so good lately with stuff like, you know, Octodad and Surgeon Simulator and a lot of these just bizarre comedy indie games that are mostly there just for laughs. I think Roundabout has a little more meat to it than that. I think as a game, it is, it's fulfilling and exciting and challenging. And there's a lot to it. Although, I mean, probably the main reason to play it is because it is funny. It's a great thing to show off to people. You're like, you won't believe how crazy this game is. And they won't believe it when they see it. It's wild. I'm very happy about it. I like Roundabout a lot. I never really got to play much of Kuru Kuru Kururin, only like, you know, TYP would let me play a couple levels of his copy when we met up at E3 like 13 years ago. But I never had it for myself, and so I'm glad to get to play that kind of thing now. And I think Roundabout is not only a great tribute to that game, but like a really good version of it that has its own style for sure. So anyway, that's on PS4 and other stuff, maybe Vita, I don't know. It's on Steam. It's probably
PS4,
cheap.
Xbox One, Vita, and PC.
Yeah, not Wii U, unfortunately, although it certainly could run on Wii U. I mean, it's not a beast or anything, but
they were having trouble with the video compression and getting the video to stream, I think.
Well, that's too bad. Roundabout is pretty cool. Okay, well, we're running a little bit long on new business, but I want to hear about at least one more game from Seren, because she's been playing so much crazy stuff lately.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Seren, what if you had to trim it down to just one more, what would you like to tell us about?
Well, I'll go Fire Emblem if, but I just want to say two things really quickly. Rhythm Heaven, the best plus is the best Rhythm Heaven. It's amazing, and I've played through the first case of The Great Ace Attorney, which just came out in Japan yesterday, and I think it's incredible.
James is on fire right now.
Two games that we don't have release information for in the West.
Yep.
Goddamn.
Two games that James needs very badly, I'm sure.
Yeah, but so Fire Emblem If.
Or Fates,
yes. Fates or, in the U.S.
Yeah. Hashtag FE.
There are there are three versions. That information's already out there. In Japan, it's basically Black Kingdom, White Kingdom, and Invisible Kingdom. In the U.S., it's Conquest, Birthright, and then they haven't given a name for the third path yet. So the storyline along with this one is that you play as a character who was brought up with the in the Nor Kingdom. So you have brothers and sisters and friends, and you love them. Your father, the evil the sort of emperor, basically, is not the most pleasant man, but you can get by, and you love people there. And so the Nor Kingdom starts to attack and invade the Hoshido Kingdom over land and food and materials and stuff. So you're part of the army on that invasion, and that's the beginning of the prologue. But then people in the Hoshido Kingdom hear your name, and they're like, what? We're missing someone named whatever your avatar's name is, Korin, because Korin was the prince or princess of this kingdom that was kidnapped as a baby by the Nor. So you have blood ties to the Hoshido Kingdom, but familial ties to the Nor Kingdom, and it sets up for this crazy conflict in Chapter 6 of the prologue, where the download version will make you choose, and if both sides start fighting, and you're right in the middle, and you gotta choose right then and there, which kingdom are you gonna align with, and then if you choose Hoshido, you gotta fight and start trying to kill almost immediately your best friends, or you have to try and start trying to kill your blood relatives. So it's a crazy tense situation that the game handles pretty well, and choosing your route changes the path of the next 21 chapters of the game.
So yeah, this is where it breaks down for me, because I've heard that's a good, really good explanation of the strange situation that Nintendo has gotten into with this game. But based on what you, I don't know how many of the campaigns you've played, but based on your experience, all of them. Okay. Do you think this game is being sold to us twice potentially because there's actually two games worth of stuff?
There are three games worth of stuff.
So that it's three times as long as Awakening?
No, because the first five chapters are the same.
But the vast majority is different.
Yep. Fire Emblem Awakening was 25 chapters. Each of the three paths in If or Fates is about 27 chapters plus an epilogue.
So that's it's a shitload of Fire Emblem, in other words.
It is a crap load, and on top of that, they haven't opened this up yet, but there's going to be a DLC store, and they've promised about as much content as Awakening got for DLC.
Which was a lot.
There is a lot of game here. It is unbelievable.
This is basically the swan song for Fire Emblem for a while, because
in Japan, I think it might be the 3DS swan song in Japan.
It would be nuts to release another Fire Emblem game for a while, because people will take forever to chew through this one.
So, yeah. The gist in terms of difficulty. If you haven't played Awakening, do that first, because the Hoshido path assumes that you've played Awakening and picks up, like, it begins around mid-game Awakening difficulty and then goes far above it. And that's the easiest path. The Nor path is for lunatics. It gets crazy. I'm gonna not give plot details on this map, but I'm gonna describe one skirmish for you. One chapter where we were on a desert terrain. So it's difficult terrain, so all your movement with non-Pegasus knights are halved, and there's wind blowing in all different directions, and so at the end of every turn, all of your characters get pushed around by the wind, sometimes off the map and out of the battle. Not only that, but the sort of sandstorm also decreases the accuracy of every single one of your attacks by 30%.
Good.
It's just this insane battle scenario that took me an hour and a half to beat. That one little chapter. There was another chapter where the enemies, the main goal was to cross the battlefield and get to the other side and get every one of your characters across. But the 6 new enemies showed up every turn.
Oh God.
It's like Codename Steam.
2 from the front, 2 from the back, and one on the left and right.
Yeah, dude, that sounds a lot like Codename Steam, actually.
And so when you get towards the end, there's just this wall of enemies that you have to break through, and you're left with, like, your weakest offensive characters, like your healers, at the end. And if you're not playing on casual or Phoenix mode, they will die. Because they cannot possibly break through this wall of 20 enemies. And so you gotta, once you get up there, the only way that you could safely get through is by guaranteeing that every turn you can get through, you can destroy 4 enemies, because then they'll spawn 2 and you'll take out 2 more than they're spawning every turn. That's another one that took me an hour and 45 minutes.
Oh boy, James is frothing at the mouth. I guess just to wrap up, Seren, quick question. Is this your favorite Fire Emblem?
Whew. Probably yes.
I mean, it sounds like you're pretty happy with it if you played through all 3 of these campaigns and they're that difficult and they're that long.
So the third path just came out yesterday, so I haven't played through it. I'm on chapter 12. The third path is the path where you basically say no to both kingdoms, run off with your friends, and try and figure out how you can stop the war altogether.
Huh.
And I would assume that one would be the most insidiously hard, or is it somewhere in the middle, please?
That's in the middle.
Oh, thank God.
Can I choose to play just that one?
Yes, but at least in Japan, that version wasn't released for 2 or 3 weeks after the base game.
Yeah, I don't care about that. But is it possible to buy it on its own? You don't have to get it as...
Well, no.
You can't, right now, in the Japanese version, you can only buy black or white, and then it is the add-on.
It is basically an expansion that requires the base game.
So give me a minute to run over how you buy this game
in
Japan.
Oh, God, no, please.
So, as of now, there are 4 SKUs in Japan. There's the retail SKU for the Black Kingdom.
SKU is stock keeping unit, or basically a product, like a version of something that you can sell.
Yes, there are 4 ways to buy this game in Japan. There's the retail Black Kingdom, where when you get to Chapter 6, you just automatically align with Nor. Or there's the retail White Kingdom, where you automatically align with Hoshido. And I don't really like those, because you don't get the first 5 chapters to get to know everyone and then make up your mind. You make your decision at the store.
Before you even know any of the characters.
Yes. There is the download version, where you download the first 5 chapters, play through them, get to Chapter 6, get to make your choice, then download the rest of that path, and you can, in all the versions, you can buy the additional paths. They're $20 each. $20 expansion packs, basically. And finally, there's the special edition in Japan, which was a retail cartridge that had basically one run, that was pre-order only, that has all 3 paths on the cartridge at launch.
Oh. Interesting.
So, they've already announced that Conquest and Birthright will be separate retail products in the West, but I hope that the special edition is as well.
Yeah, because Nintendo of America handles special editions great.
They handle stock of any item really great at retail these days. First it was scarves, then it was Majora's Mask statues, then it was Majora's Mask 3DSs, and now it's just all amiibo.
I wish John was here to go into a rant about scarves.
I'm pretty sure we're safe from Fire Emblem scarves anyway. Yeah, that's not a product. Yet.
Fire Emblem Amiibo will be a disaster. But Fire
Emblem are an Amiibo. They are an Amiibo disaster. They're pretty much the four rarest Amiibo are the four Fire Emblem Amiibo, which are compatible with this game.
Not that you'll ever know that.
Well, I own all four because I'm a raving lunatic, and I'm playing this on a new 3DS XL. So, I've tested all the Amiibo. And what happens is you scan the Amiibo in, and then you can fight against... For instance, if you scan in Robin, the protagonist from Awakening, you play against a party of Awakening characters, and then if you beat them, you can have Robin join your party.
Forever?
Yep.
That's cool.
Is he still he or she still super overpowered?
He only, with the Amiibo, which I was very pleased about.
Is it actually just the Amiibo? Like, looks just like the Amiibo version of it?
Yep. It's the default male with the gray hair, with the silver hair.
And is it still just a massively overpowered class, just breaks everything?
Yes.
Good. That's what I want.
All four of them are massively overpowered.
Good. That's what they should be.
That's what I would expect.
Ike has very limited movement, but can basically one-shot the final boss. it's really
God
great.
God damn it.
Yeah. I've heard similar things about the implementation in Codename Steam. Not that I've tried it myself, and nor do I really care about it. But
Codename Steam's Amiibo support was interesting in that is a game all about guns, and ranged attacks. But all four of the Fire Emblem characters were melee characters in that game.
Yep.
So the enemies always won. Because they could shoot you from a range that you couldn't move to in one turn, and then they would run away from you that range and then attack you again.
Yep, that sounds about right. Well, Siren, we're going to have to wrap up your business. There's a lot of other games I'd like to quiz you about, actually, because you play more games than probably the rest of us combined, and that's saying something when James is in the formula. But anyway, we'll have to do it another time. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. And as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've been getting lots of emails lately and lots of good ones, and we're not going to be able to do them all, but we're going to try to get through a few of the most interesting ones from lately. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking if not next week or very soon, we should do like a real full-on thunder round. So if you have some like very short to-the-point questions that you'd like to get in, if you just like a chance to be on the show, this would be a very good one because we'll go through a lot of people's emails this way. So if you've never had a question answered on the show, this would be a good time to jump into it. Low hurdle. Anyway, send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And of course, there's always a link in the article on our website to do it as well. So let's kick it off with Siren. Would you mind reading this first email?
Sure. Bottle writes, I've also tried to go back to the original Pikmin and the new play control, and I find them almost unplayable. Pikmin 3's controls are so good, it's incredibly difficult to go back. I would love it if they remade the first two Pikmins with Pikmin 3's controls, but I certainly don't have my hopes up. For a 100% fruit speedrun without glitches, 12 days is the goal, and doing 9 days while getting limited fruit can be a nice warm-up. I've done this tons of times, and yes, it has cut into my time for playing other games. If you have more fun, I would be more than happy to give the basic formula I use for the 12 days, but for now, I'm just thankful that Pikmin 3 is still part of the conversation at RFN.
Not for much longer. About to put a moratorium on this crazy shit.
Yeah,
cool. You're not the only one, Guillaume.
Yeah, I enjoy talking about games, and especially just, you know, games I like. That's even better.
I like that we're now the speedrun.com exclusively for Pikmin 3 conversation.
All right, well, it's kind of funny because, you know, last week I talked about Pikmin 3. I said, okay, so I established my new record, like 39 days or something? 29 days.
29, I think it was.
And you know, and I've kept playing. I said, oh, okay, I'm probably good. I've had my fix, but I've actually gone back through the game again. Got down to 22 days. I was feeling pretty good about myself. And then I'd read this email, and it's just like, yeah, 12 days is really what you want to aim for. And that's if you don't exploit glitches and stuff. And, well, okay, thanks, Buttle. Now I, you know, I don't know if I'm going to actually keep going. Like, this time it's true. I don't think I really want to truly, seriously speedrun this thing. But
well,
I
do... now we have to ask the question, what kind of man are you? When you hear from a challenge like this, do you decide to step up your game
and hone your
skills and become Rocky and do the Pikmin 3 speedrun in 12 days or less? Or do you decide, oh, okay, so this is what it looks like when someone plays just Pikmin 3 for like 2 years, and I don't want to do that. I don't, you know, like I've already played plenty of Pikmin 3.
I like that how you describe this is to shame both sides of his options here. So either are you a coward or are you an obsessive monster?
No, I think I'm pretty, to be honest, like I take my life lessons from Homer Simpson, who famously said that there will always be people better at something than you. So why even try, you know?
Why even try?
That's the motto of this show. Why even try?
So then are you going to move on then? Is that your decision?
Yeah, probably. No, I kind of wanted to use this email as a springboard to just touch on a few things that, because I really want to convince people to give Pikmin 3 a chance, to give it a shot. Because playing 1 and then 3 really highlighted the differences in design between the two games, and I think that a lot of people who may not have enjoyed the first one and skipped the third one based on that might actually enjoy 3 a lot more than they think they would. Because in the first Pikmin game, you go back to that and you realize that there is no pathfinding at all. The Pikmin fall off ledges all the time, and that kind of becomes the main thing that you do in the game, basically, is platforming and is trying to make sure to keep all your Pikmin with you, and you're kind of babysitting them all the time. And you will have like quote unquote puzzles where really it's just that you'll try to walk to some ledge, and turns out like none of your Pikmin can follow you, so you have to throw them on the ledge and then climb there and then call them to you. And it's just like these very I don't know. Like these series of steps that are not all that engaging, you know, lots of micromanagement. And Pikmin 3 dispenses with all of that. It doesn't have the whole Pikmin that trip up, you know, they actually can keep up with you. And that's great, because they've got this whole mechanic now of you have three captains and you can send a group of Pikmin somewhere and kind of stop paying attention to it. And while they're making their way to the place you want them to go, you can be doing something else. So, yeah, it's good that they don't just trip up and you know, like that. You don't need to babysit them, because the whole point is that they're going to go where you want them to go. But, so that enables, like, that kind of changes the game from a platforming challenge and a kind of, like, not a babysitting challenge, but, you know, like the kind of micromanagement stuff.
Yeah, I was going to use that word, actually. I was kind of thinking the same way, because the first Pikmin especially, you're usually concerned with every single individual Pikmin. Like, the game trains you to cherish them and try not to let any die. It makes you feel really bad about when they die. And a lot of the game is sort of herding Pikmin through very tight spaces, or, you know, over convoluted series of objects that, you know, you have to throw them onto or knock them down from somewhere else, et cetera, building bridges. And a lot of times it feels like you are kind of responsible for every single individual Pikmin in it. And I do think 3 does a better job of making them feel more like this kind of swarm that's following you. And they're semi-autonomous. You don't have to micromanage them, like you said. And it lets you be more the mastermind of the strategy, which is, you know, you're trying to divide up these large forces and you have three different captains. There's a lot to juggle in Pikmin 3. It gives you a lot of tools, and you don't want to have to be fooling around with just trying to get this one single Pikmin over through the water. I feel like the game has more of an attitude of like, yeah, just kind of let it die. It's not worth it. You'll go make another one, you know?
Right, but at the same time, it's kind of easier to not let them die if you pay attention to them and if you know right. what you're doing. And yeah, like it's no StarCraft like John mentioned last week, but it is more of a resource management game, you know, because you can send a captain back to the base and pick up the Pikmin that might have sprouted at the base, or you can go pick up the Pikmin that went back there and just, you know, because they brought treasure back. And so, like, you make sure that everyone is busy doing something at all times while you're doing something else. And so it might not sound like it's fun, but it is. I think that people who are RTS fans, real-time strategy fans, might really take to Pikmin 3 more than they did to 1, and I think that people... I'm not so much into real-time strategy games anymore. I tried to get into StarCraft 2, and it was... I don't know. That moment has passed, I guess, for me. But Pikmin 3 has... I don't know. It's not too overwhelming, you know?
Yeah.
So it still manages to be enjoyable, and if you want to make it hard on yourself, then you can do like Buttle does and just... try to achieve crazy times and finish the game
super
quickly.
Try to achieve very impressive, we're all very impressed, Buttle, times.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think there's probably a great freelance game journalism article about, you know, how Splatoon is doing for shooters, what Pikmin did for real-time strategy. I think there's a lot of fun parallels between the two and how they tackle certain issues that, you know, drove people away earlier. And they kind of adapt and modify this well-worn genre into something that is more accessible but still very rich and still has a ton of depth and is satisfying to people who can easily play, you know, the more traditional hardcore versions of them. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, I certainly agree that Pikmin 3 is a really good game. I don't know if I'll ever love a game as much as you love Pikmin 3, Guillaume, but I'm glad you're still talking about it, and I also want to say... I hope Buttle knows I'm just joking around with him because he's a very long-time listener of not only this show but some other podcasts that I'm on, and I appreciate him a lot.
Keep the dream alive. Mm.
I'm very impressed by his prowess at Pikmin 3.
Yeah, very very quickly, I thought like the whole HD Pikmin 1 and 2 thing, I thought about it, but it's not just the controls that make Pikmin 1 and 2 less good. It's also like the design issues that I mentioned. And I... You know, like because Pikmin 3 sold not very well, as far as we can tell, I think that chances of a sequel anytime soon are very slim. And I think that even like an HD,
but it yeah, already was, probably even before Pikmin 3, it was in hibernation, really.
But then I thought about what they did with Nintendo Land, like they kind of transformed it into some sort of a dungeon crawler, and I was thinking, you know. Not only Nintendo made the Nintendo Land minigame, and not only did they go back and patch Pikmin 3 like almost a year after it came out to add touch controls, but yeah, like not only that, but also they're eyeing iPhone games or, you know, mobile games. And I'm thinking, you know, if something is going to redeem the series, it just might be the mobile, whatever mobile games come out in the future.
So you're
Nintendo.
Saying you want a Pikmin Mystery Dungeon?
I'm not saying that at all. I'm not
even
saying
like
I want
Angry Birds kind of deal.
No,
Angry
I don't. Pikmin's... I'm not even saying I
he's
want
saying
like some
he
sort
wants
of
glitter Pikmin. Is what he's saying.
No, I don't want Tiny Tower Pikmin. Anything. I'm not into mobile. I probably wouldn't. Well, never say never.
Yes, you
but
would play
I'm,
it.
Yeah. Anyway. But
you, totally
you know,
but
I
could
think...
also be a 3DS game. I mean, you could certainly see like a dungeon crawly kind of, which Pikmin 2 was that as well.
Sure, but like the whole time management thing, you could see translate very well to some sort of iPhone game, I think.
Yeah.
And the kind of mechanics they have of making you pay over time to speed up some stuff could be very, very dangerous.
Oh, boy.
Scary. That said, I think that there is definitely a possibility that they throw New Play Control Pikmin 1 and 2 up on the Wii U eShop and say, hey, if you own Pikmin 3, take 10% off.
That would be neat. But I right now it doesn't look like Nintendo is interested in putting any Wii games at all. Not in
they
North America
in
anyway. Yeah.
In Japan, you can download Trauma Team to your Wii U.
What? How
fucked up
get
is
out
that?
Of here.
God damn it!
That
you
is
can
100%
download
true.
Trauma Team, Galaxy 1, Zangeki no Regen Leave, Sin and Punishment, Star Successor.
Yeah. Trauma Team, a.k.a. in Japan, it's also known as Hospital : Six Doctors.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that's... Well, you know, actually, that it should be called Hospital : a Shit Ton of Cocaine, because that's what that game is.
But it's Trauma the best. Team is so awesome. Anyway.
It's one of the Wii's best games.
I'm going to read the next email, and this one comes from Tyler. And Tyler writes, "Do you feel that Nintendo is releasing too many Zelda games? From 2011 through 2016, there will have been Ocarina of Time 3D, Skyward Sword, Four Swords Anniversary Edition, Wind Waker HD, A Link Between Worlds, Hyrule Warriors, Majora's Mask 3D, Triforce Heroes, Hyrule Warriors All-Stars, and Zelda Wii U. While, of course, not Mario levels of exposure, is Nintendo running the risk of taking away Zelda's event status?"
Until there are more Zelda games coming out than Etrian games, no.
I mean, I would point out that only... So, you know, we were discussing the relative lack of Metroid games a while ago, and I know this is going to come up in a minute, but I want to point out that if you actually look at new mainline Zelda games since the release of the first Metroid Prime game, you're dealing with about roughly the same number of mainline console Zelda games. I mean, those games themselves are very, very infrequent.
Well, you say mainline console, but I mean, I think the 3DS games are, you know, especially Link Between Worlds
not Link Between Worlds.
Is on par with the Zelda status of a... Well, it's not on par, but I still think those are major games. I think they're canonical games.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them. Not Four Swords, but, you know, stuff like Spirit Tracks and Link Between Worlds are canonical, you know, Zelda games. And the fact that, I mean, Zelda's been so great on handhelds going back to the 90s that, to me, Zelda games.
But those games don't have the same event status on them. I mean,
no, they don't, because
they
come
never
out
have.
More often.
They never have, and they never have, though. Even when they weren't coming out more often.
They come out two at a time at once. So,
the Zelda games that have the big event cachet are the big console releases.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there haven't been that many of them. So they still have their own place. And and I think that makes sense. I mean, think about the fact that it was an event when we got Wind Waker HD remake. I mean, it was like, okay, whoa, there's a new Zelda game coming. Wow, this Zelda game coming again. I mean, these games are events because of what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they persist to be unique, they persist to exist on their own plane, which it is impossible for Nintendo to just jam these games out at the speed they would need to deprive them of this event status, because Zelda Wii U has apparently been in development since the Pleistocene era, that essentially these games can't lose it. All these weird spin-off-y games, I mean, you could even go back to the fact games like Spirit Tracks, which were in the bargain bin within a year. I mean, those games have always kind of had a certain disposability to them. I mean, Hyrule Warriors sold well, but it sold well because it was this kind of goofy thing on Wii U, and
it was on Wii U, and it was a retail game.
Yeah, and people, I think, were to a certain extent intrigued by it. I mean,
that game's gonna do well on 3DS?
No,
I think in Japan it might.
Oh, in Japan it's gonna sell well. Here,
I don't think so.
It'll probably do passing numbers enough to justify its existence. But I think as long as those games continue to be special, and, you know, barring Nintendo picking up another 100,000 developers and pulling an Ubisoft and having 14 studios working on it at the same time, those games are always going to have a big gap between them. I think those will be
fine.
And
it should be that way,
frankly. Yeah. Okay, without saying that Zelda games don't have a lot of work put into them, I think this whole, like, Zelda releases are an event thing is very subjective. Like, it's an event to who? They're not exactly shattering sale records. Especially not the recent entries.
But it is a major noteworthy release in the ecosphere that we operate, the enthusiast.
Well, not just us, but I would argue that Zelda, like sometimes Metroid games, and like usually most big Mario games, these are Nintendo releases that people who aren't like us and who don't pay attention to Nintendo all the time actually take note of and are interested in and have a stake in. Like people, you know, even people who may not even ever play the next Zelda game, they're interested in whether or not it's good. They're interested in whether it has anything new to show. They would consider playing it in a way that they will never consider playing the new Fire Emblem. So it is on a different tier of event status than most of the games that we talk about and most of the games that Nintendo puts out. It is a very high-profile series.
Whenever I would be listening to a podcast about around the time that Skyward Sword came out, like, yes, the multi-platform podcast would talk about Zelda in a way that they wouldn't talk about other Nintendo releases, but then it was almost always to kind of crap on it. So I'm just not sure what the status of the series is anymore in the U.S. And I kind of wonder if, you know, Tyler writes that there's too many, it's losing, the series is kind of losing its event status. I kind of wonder if no releases or, you know, kind of these gaps between releases is not actually achieving that. It's kind of taking away the event status. People forget about Zelda and they keep playing Batman, they keep playing Assassin's Creed, and Zelda is just like this old thing.
Yeah, I mean, for most people, I think you're right. I think Zelda is this thing that you kind of turn your head and look at every 5 years, because the vast majority of the games that Tyler listed there, most people have never heard of them or not that interested. Or they say, oh yeah, Majora's Mask, I played that, you know, when I was in high school or when I was in college a long time ago, and I don't need to play through it again. I mean, I think it's mostly good that there are more Zelda games than there used to be. I mean, certainly, you know, including the spinoffs and the fact that we now have, you know, concurrent console and handheld series going by various developers. There's a lot more Zelda games coming out year to year than there were when I was a kid growing up, when I loved Zelda just as much as I do now. And generally, I think that's good. And for Nintendo's fans, you know, they're loyal people who do pay attention to everything that comes out and they buy a lot of it and they play a lot of it. I think it's generally good for them that they can keep engaging with the franchise on a more regular, frequent basis. That's what they want. That's what they talked about
at E3 this year. They talked about having spinoffs to let you re-engage with these franchises.
So one thing that I find interesting about how Nintendo treats the handheld games versus the console games is that until this year, where they really needed stuff to announce at E3, the handheld games were never really announced at E3. Link Between Worlds was a direct. Spirit Tracks was freaking GDC.
Oh, like, God, that's right. Well,
yeah, they announced
almost always playable at E3, sometimes for the first time.
But, like, you wouldn't see them announce Zelda Wii U at GDC. You wouldn't see them announce, like, Skyward Sword at Edge Developers. Like,
I don't even think Skyward Sword was announced at E3. I think it was announced outside.
It was announced at E3. The concept art was shown at E3.
Yeah,
and then
you were there, Johnny.
The first trailer was E3.
Yeah, that's right.
But you were in the room.
That's when they had the technical difficulties on stage as well. That was the first announcement.
Yeah.
They had
that was
directs
that
weren't
was
a thing
the,
yet.
That was the incident.
Yes. No, don't. That's going to get edited out.
Well, they know it happens. They knew it happens.
So, we'll save that one for the book, James. That story is way too big to get into right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think, you know, there is a minor penalty to this approach, which is that the Zelda brand gets diluted a little bit in terms of excitement because you get it so frequently. I think Nintendo runs the risk of when they do put out one of these console games, which cost, I'm sure, orders of magnitude more than all these other games that we talked about.
I mean,
you know, these are huge productions. They really matter to the company. And I wonder if the amount that they stand out from everything else is a little bit diminished by the fact that there's just a lot of stuff with Zelda on the box. But you know what? I wish Metroid had that problem. I'm not really complaining. And I like most of these games.
It's also worth noting that with very few exceptions, none of these games are, like, they've been cutting down on the expense of, like, every Zelda game. So Ocarina of Time 3D, it's a remake outsourced to Gretzo. Skyward Sword was enormous, and that's almost certainly why they decided to cut back on the costs, because that game was in development for like 5-6 years, and most of that was developing the engine and the controls. Four Swords Anniversary Edition was a GBA port to DSiWare. Wind Waker HD used the Wind Waker engine upscaled. A Link Between Worlds used its own engine, but then they're capitalizing with that using the same engine for Triforce Heroes. Hyrule Warriors uses the Dynasty Warriors legend, Dynasty Warriors engine. Majora's Mask 3D uses the same engine as Ocarina of Time 3D, and Zelda Wii U uses the Xenoblade Cross engine. So they've been going through
Probably modified quite a bit.
Yes, modified, but in terms of graphics and streaming in an open world.
Like, and that's a good thing.
It's 100% the exact same engine, and like they've all but confirmed that. And so I'm just looking at this, and I'm thinking, you know what? Even while they're putting out all these games, they're being really smart about how they're handling the finances regarding it.
Yeah, and some of these games venture on, I'm not going to name names, but some of them venture on fan service, and they're probably lower budget things that are put out there to satisfy the people who are crazy and want to buy every single Zelda game, no matter what it is, because they like the characters and they like the world and they like the music and the sound effects. And, you know, for, you know, I'm certainly, I have much less interest in that stuff than I do. Even like Triforce Heroes, I played it. It's fun. It's totally Four Swords. It's just one less person.
Three swords.
I mean, it's the same thing.
And they have four,
fun.
But that was too much.
I will probably buy it and play it over Skype online with some of you. But, you know, I'm looking forward to it, but am I excited about that game? Nah, dog. I've played it. That game ain't doing anything very fresh from what I've seen. Zelda on the Wii U is what's exciting is that that is something completely new for that series, and it's still a huge mystery, of course. But that I have far greater anticipation for that Wii U game or NX game or whatever the hell it is nowadays.
It's a Wii U game.
Yeah. Well, I think it will definitely come out on Wii U. I think it might also come out on NX, but
if it does, Wii U's definitely going to be the lead platform because that's where the technology was developed for.
Well, let's wrap up listener mail here. I think we've got time for one more, and James is going to read this one.
Oh, this is Zup.
Yeah.
Zup writes, help us stop this atrocity of a game from help us stop this atrocity of a game from bearing the beloved Metroid franchise name, and make Nintendo halt production on it. This is a quote from a petition that already has 12,000 signatures on it. While I understand the disappointment of Metroid fans, I was hoping for a side-scrolling sequel to Metroid Fusion myself.
Yeah.
Don't you think this is a bit over the top? Do you think this is a reasonable response to the Metroid Prime Federation Forces announcement? And of course, most importantly, which of you will be signing this petition?
John, because he's not here.
Yeah, of course it's reasonable.
I was tempted
you don't, sign any game petition that involves Metroid being canceled.
I was tempted to sign it mostly as a joke, just to sign it and be like, yeah, just because it's such an insane thing that it seemed like the funny thing to do at that moment in time. And then I realized that I'm guessing a lot of the signatures on this thing are kind of jokes. So
Reggie was in interviews at E3 joking about it, saying like, before you get online and create a petition or sign a petition to cancel one of our games, why don't you play it first?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to have played it, except it wasn't at E3.
Yeah.
Well, so, it was, but only for Treehouse.
No one I know has played this game, really.
I have, but can't talk about it.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly very curious to try it, and to learn more about it, but you know, the sentiment, and I wanted to read this letter. I wanted to talk about this petition. I briefly covered it. Neil and I did on the Game Trailers Live thing, which I'm trying to find a way to make that more accessible to our listeners. So stay tuned on that. But I think last week I promised a video link and I forgot to do that. So I'll definitely do it this week. I'll send you a link and tell you how far to skip ahead in this very long like all day long live stream that Game Trailers did. And Neil and I kind of stepped into it in hour 7 or 8, I think. But we covered this a little bit, the petition, and, you know, that was kind of a casual, you know, friendly thing, and we didn't spend that much time on it. But I really found it very disturbing, actually, when I heard about this petition. Like, at first I kind of laughed and said, wow, I can't believe somebody did that. And when I heard about how many people signed it, it really kind of upset me a little bit. You know, I mean, I'm not thrilled about Federation Force. I'm trying to be open-minded about it. I haven't played it myself yet, and I don't want to judge it until I do. But it's not what I was hoping to see this year at E3. I mean, I think that's pretty damn obvious. It's not what anybody wanted or expected to see at E3, because it's kind of an unpredictable. I say that here with Guillaume, who did actually predict it, but you know, he did it somewhat facetiously, I think. And moreover, I mean, this just isn't like any Metroid game that's ever been made. Not really. You know, they're doing completely new things with it that you really couldn't see coming. And so Nintendo's throwing it out there. And if you're going to do that, you know, and I applaud them, by the way. I'm glad they're trying new things. I don't know if this one's going to work out, but just like with Codename Steam, it's like, yes, you're trying to make new kinds of things. You're trying new things, and I support that, and I'm interested in it. I want you to do it well, and you know, I'm sure there'll be things they can improve on, but it's important to Nintendo's games and their development staff that they keep innovating. So I don't want them to just make another Metroid that's exactly like all the other ones. You know, I want them to keep doing new things, and maybe this is a good way to do it. But if you're going to put out a game that no one really understands at first blush, I mean, it's not a high concept game. It's not something that you can very easily explain and kind of get the idea across. You probably need to spend more time with it. Like, you know, talking about what it is, showing people what, and not in the middle of some Treehouse Live thing on Wednesday in the middle of the workday, but I mean, in your Nintendo Directs, in the announcement, or let the media play it. We'll write about it and tell people about it and make our own videos about it. But this is a game that Nintendo's done so far a poor job of getting out the information on it. Uh-huh. And that's their fault. But at the same time, I will say, I believe very strongly in constructive criticism in all aspects of life, and I think you should really consider your intentions, and I think you should really consider what the effect that signing a petition like this could possibly have, because it's almost impossible that you're going to actually get the result that the petition calls for. Okay, I'm pretty damn sure that will not happen. You probably, because of the way this is phrased in a very insulting manner, will not even kind of get the ear of the people making it at Nintendo and Next Level Games, because they're going to know that you're already inclined to hate them and hate what they're doing, even though you know almost nothing about it. So they're probably not going to listen seriously to your criticisms or your suggestions. And the fact that you're asking people to cancel the thing that they may have been working on for 3 years, for all we know, and put their entire life's energy into it, and you're saying, you know, I haven't even played your game, I don't know anything about it, but I'd prefer if you just kind of canceled it and went off and killed yourself. That is an extremely negative sentiment to be putting out in the world. And I don't think most of the people who signed this probably thought it through to that extent or realized that there are other people on the other end of this who might actually be working on the game in some capacity and read this. And they say, wow, these people hate me for no reason. You know,
oh yeah,
they're so pissed off, and these are people trying to create something for you to make you happy. Now they may fuck it up real bad, and I think that remains to be seen. I don't know, but give them a chance. You know, just because this isn't what you wanted doesn't mean it shouldn't exist. I mean, what kind of headspace is that? You know, if any of our listeners sign this petition, in an unironic way, I would really ask that you kind of step back and say, wait a minute. What does it say when I participate in something like this? What good could possibly come out of it? And I would say none. So I really would just recommend that people not get involved in stuff like this. This is, I get that it feels like grassroots activism and it's like Operation Rainfall, but this is the opposite of Operation Rainfall. It is the exact opposite of it, and I don't think you should support it or have anything to do with it.
So Unseen 64 has put up a video recently about development in the Metroid franchise. mostly about Metroid Prime Hunters, but they also touch on Metroid Dread, which was a sequel to Metroid Fusion that for DS that looked just like it, and it was in development, and then they, I think in early 2008, they sort of just quietly shuffled it away. But the gist of that, and from what I can't go into specifics, but what I know to be true, is that Nintendo has spent the last, basically since Prime 3, because Other M was not even like their main focus. That was more Team Ninja and letting Sakamoto do Sakamoto. But Nintendo has been looking at this since 2007 and trying to think of what innovative ways to take this game. And one of the big reasons Dread was canceled was because they weren't doing, and it wasn't doing anything that other games weren't. Like, you look at Axiom Verge, you look at all these amazing indie games that are doing Metroid, and that's great. So Metroid's already being done, so Nintendo's probably just looking at, well, what can we do with Metroid that's true to Metroid that's also new? And this isn't their main step, certainly. They said that at Treehouse Live. This is one of those brand engagement games, and it's not a traditional Metroid game, and they did a really, really poor job announcing it. Yes. They chose a poor venue when they're not going to have it playable. Yeah. They had many faults. It should have been at a Direct, preceded and followed by a brief explanation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That is all on Nintendo. What are you doing?
The job remains for them to prove to us that it's a cool game that has a lot of new stuff in it that we should be excited to play. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've really done that yet, but it's very early goings. It's not coming out for a while, so I still have a lot of hope that they're going to fix the course that this game is on, and I have some degree of faith that it'll turn out to be a pretty good game. Next Level hasn't made a bad game for Nintendo.
Nope.
And they've done quite a few. I mean, Luigi's Mansion on 3DS is really good.
So is Punch-Out.
Punch-Out's really good. They've done a lot of great stuff. So I feel strongly that this will turn out well. I hope that they really do have some good ideas to keep it cool. I mean, at the same time, I'll say, just because there's games like Axiom Verge and Ori and the Blind Forest out there doesn't mean Nintendo's ideas are all getting stolen away, or that their thunder's being stolen, and that they shouldn't bother making their own Metroid games in that style. I think Nintendo could absolutely still make an incredible 2D Metroid if they really wanted to.
Oh, I think so too.
And obviously they've tried, and they gave up on it because they weren't making good progress. And the thing is, that happens a lot at Nintendo, and we don't usually hear about it. This place, Unseen 64, has lately had quite a string of interesting investigations, and I haven't looked into it enough to know that, you know, that I completely trust the sources or the information there. You think it's all very legit?
My sources, who are different than their sources, have been telling me the same things for years.
Interesting. Okay.
Hmm.
That's good to know.
Everything, the last three Nintendo videos about Project Hammer, Metroid, and Devil's Third, with one exception in the Project Hammer video, I've understood and knew just about everything as fact.
Okay.
So you can have.
I was going to point out that I was trying to dig up the old comments on Planet GameCube's news announcement for Metroid Prime being a first-person adventure game.
That's a pretty deep dive there, James. You're going to have a hard time.
Wow.
Well, I was struggling with it because when we moved site architectures a few times ago, we broke the link between the talkback and the articles.
Well, and also I think our current forum archives only go back to about 2003.
Yeah, they do.
And this obviously would have been back in
the Grand Purge. But I recall what they were. Unfortunately, yeah. I can't dig out quotes. And they were amazing, actually.
Eclectic, actually.
I'll
defend myself and say, at the time I said, let's see how it turns out. I'm interested.
I can confirm that on the IGN boards, the reaction was similar. That no one wanted this.
Same with Wind Waker. Wind Waker. Yeah, and that was
from
announced.
The same. That was from the same producer, Kensuke Tanabe.
Was it Johnny, from
the same Space World? It might have been the same Space World that they showed these at.
I think it was.
I mean, it's.
Guillaume.
Sorry. Well, I kind of want to say, like, Johnny, you said that my prediction was kind of facetious. It was probably the least facetious prediction I've ever made. Like, it just makes...
Every prediction we make is facetious.
No, but, like, it was probably one of the more serious ones, because to me, it just makes so much sense. Maybe not a game that looks like Federation Force does. It's certainly cartoonier than I expected, but this whole... kind of fleshing out a game's world or a franchise's world thing has been done many, many times before. And like my go-to example usually is Star Wars. You know, once upon a time there was only in the galaxy far, far away. There was only three movies, and that was it, right? And you could read the novelizations, and you were kind of starved for content. But eventually, you know, LucasArts or Lucasfilm Games. Came up with these new stories, and you could play as an X-Wing pilot. And I don't know. I don't recall people going like, "Oh, that's so dumb. Why are you not playing as Luke Skywalker or Han Solo or something?" But it was a fantastic game, and they kind of kept... They've always had that tendency to kind of flesh out the world around it and kind of use the stuff that you see in the movies to create... a game experience that with different characters but in the same kind of setting, and it just makes sense that you would do the same thing with Metroid.
So to avoid us getting accused of mischaracterizing the tenor of much of the people who are upset about this game, which I think to diffuse it immediately is that this game's existence does not preclude the existence of other Metroid products.
Well, of course.
That, in fact, the previous email illustrates that point. There have not been a lot of mainline Zelda games since Metroid Prime 1 came out. In fact, there have been the same number of mainline console games in both series. Whether or not you want to count Other M, it counts. But the creation of these enhanced universe spin-off titles and titles they've handed off to other developers to do something with the franchise has not diminished the existence of those games. They just take a long time to make.
I mean, these spin-off games might actually ensure the future existence of these franchises. They kind of prove to Nintendo and to their shareholders that the fans of these series are around and they will buy every game that comes out.
Well, and alternatively, it keeps those franchises in the consciousness.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the biggest problem that I think the Metroid games have had... Now, I want to point out that if people who were really expecting, oh, it's time for Retro's other game, forgot that Retro's last game came out 13 months or 14 months before E3, something like that. I mean, it really hadn't been that long since they finished Tropical Freeze.
Well, no, but I think we were expecting an announcement of a game coming out in late 2016 or even out into 2017. I mean, they've done that before with Metroid Prime 3.
But they had told us they weren't going to do that.
I know, but Metroid Prime 3 was announced in 2005 at E3.
They told us explicitly that was what they weren't going to do this year.
This year, E3 was, let's not talk about anything past next E3, because next E3 we're going to unveil that we stopped caring about Wii U and it's NX.
I mean, that seems to be what they were telling us. And, well, I mean,
look, it's a problem for Nintendo when they say, we're going to focus on this stuff. We're going to focus on the stuff that's coming out in the next year. And then the stuff that they show, a whole lot of people come away from it and say, I don't really want a lot of that stuff. So it's obviously a problem that Nintendo created for themselves by narrowing the scope so much to make it immediate. But that it also says a lot about their upcoming lineup, or at least how they're presenting it so far.
I think
it's a lot of people are kind of like, Mario Maker looks cool and the rest, fuck it.
Well, we talked about the fact that, you know, they took the cover off Genbun Roku Sharp FE, you know, about 3 months beforehand for some reason. Like, if they had really actually unveiled that game, if Xenoblade Chronicles X wasn't already out in Japan.
That's the thing. That's out in Japan. Fire Emblem IF came out the week after in Japan, and Yoshi was coming out 2 weeks later in Europe.
It was, to a certain extent, it was just a lot of these games that they've got coming out in their release window are known quantities, and It was a, you know, we talked about this. Some of it was presentational. Some of it was just bad timing. E3 was at a very inconvenient time for them because of when they have games coming out. And to a certain extent, they talked about stuff they didn't need to talk about early just to keep interest going. So I it was based on everything, based on A, when their last game came out, and B, what Nintendo had told us, to expect Retro to show up with a Metroid Prime game ready to show was insane. Yeah. And so people who are upset because that wasn't announced are insane. It's, I mean, there is no physical way a 3D Metroid game could be on a new hardware that's never had a Metroid game, so there's no engine to build off of, would be in a state that it can be shown right now. It's
well,
just not
a reason none of us predicted that it would be there this year.
Right.
And in this case, we were right.
Because to have predicted it would have been simply giving into wish fulfillment.
But hey, Nintendo's not beyond that. They've done it before.
But
Sony did
a
lot this year.
But that's just it. They said they weren't going to do that this year, and they didn't lie to us. Like, if you took them at face value, A, you would have been right, and B, it wasn't going to be there.
Am I remembering incorrectly that before last year's E3, they told us that we shouldn't expect to see Zelda, and they showed it at the end anyway?
Well,
They said Zelda won't be playable.
Okay.
And
because they'd already announced it at that point.
Yeah, and the only reason they showed it last year was because they were truly convinced it was going to be a 2015 game. Otherwise, they would not have shown that game.
Right. They would have done this year what they did last year, basically do the tease.
Now, James, do you believe that they really thought it would come out in 2015?
No.
I think that's a lie?
I think somebody in the C-suite might have said, well, maybe we can get it out in 2015.
I think that executives that weren't necessarily working on the game, who are not going to name names, believed that, yes, it was going to be, and then they got back to Kyoto and asked the team, and they're like, hell no, it's not going to be ready.
Like, at this point, when does Nintendo think a Zelda game is going to come out? I think it's almost as relevant as when we think the Zelda game is going to come out, because I don't think they know any better than we do at this point. It's
well,
just like,
and
they'll
hey,
know
we'll
3 months before.
E3s, whatever, who cares?
They'll know 3 months before.
I'm glad you brought in the Zelda comparison, because I also want to note that Nintendo has a very long history of announcing and showing Zelda games far, far in advance of when they actually come out.
And too early, really.
You could argue too early, but there is a very different, there's a huge difference in how they announce and present Zelda games in advance of release versus how they've done for Metroid. Even though the same number of big console titles in these series have been coming out over the past decade or so, Metroid games are almost always announced much closer to release, and they show much less of it before the game actually comes out.
Except for Other M.
Well, I mean, Other M got announced in June, and it came out in December.
Next year.
It came out
in, like, September of the next, or August, maybe.
August of the
like,
next year.
It was, like, 14
God,
or 15
right.
months after it was originally
yes.
shown, which,
it was
mean,
at both E3s.
Show me a Zelda game that came out 15 months after it was announced. There aren't many of them.
I mean, mainline Zelda game, it's probably been
probably
since Majora's Mask.
On
Majora's Mask is probably it.
Ocarina of Time 3D, that's all I can think of.
I mean, for a console mainline game, it would have to be Majora's Mask, because that game had such a short development window anyway.
Yeah.
It was probably at a Space World, and then it was out the next Christmas.
I think even that one was announced like 2 years before it came out in America. But
well, that
anyway,
was when it was Zelda Gaiden.
Metroid just isn't, it isn't hyped up by Nintendo the way that Zelda is. It's not as popular of a series, but they do come out on about the same frequency. That's a great point, but they are handled very differently, and so the fans of these series, you see that they respond to Nintendo's behavior differently. That's
well, and
all I'm pointing
out. I think the other thing is that I might get crucified for this. They made too many Metroid Prime games too quickly, honestly.
I think two could have used another year in the oven to polish it up. It would have helped to split it away from Halo 2. They came out on the same day. Very bad choice.
I hold up 3 as sort of the highlight of the franchise to myself. But, like, even that isn't that far from 2. Not really. So I wonder if in doing that, because also in there we had Fusion and we had the remake. I wonder if...
And Hunters.
Yeah, and Hunters. I mean, you could throw... you could throw in pinball too. Like, they just went kind of Metroid crazy there for a while, and I think that really
it
what
was
we've seen,
so great. Yeah.
What we've seen is more of a regression to form. Like this,
yeah,
like
I know.
Like this is what the like.
And 64 didn't have any games.
It was weird. Like there was a window there where we were getting Metroid games way more frequently than we were getting Zelda games.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And like this is just sort of like they've gone back to like, okay, that was, we got a little nuts there, guys. Let's
remember that we never saw a polygonal Samus Aran until 1999 when Super Smash Brothers came out.
Yep. And then that's
how non-existent Metroid was on the N64.
And then they just went. I mean, we didn't. There was a rumor of an N64 Metroid, but it was.
There was absolutely one in development.
Yep.
Yeah.
Trust me, I used to have a huge section on my old website about it. It was the stuff of early internet folklore, and it was a lot of fun to try to track it all down. But yes, they absolutely were working on it at some point. But Miyamoto, he never liked the way it was going.
Yeah, and so to a certain extent, that series needed time after, you know, its primary champion was no longer there, and they had to sort of recenter it. And so there's a certain explanation for why that game took a while, but the. Ultimately, Federation Force is made by a team of people that we believe make. I mean, we have no evidence that the games they've made with Nintendo are going to be poor. I had some issues with Luigi's Mansion 2. We talked about them on the show. Punch Out is amazing. I have no issues with that game. Like, I'm expecting that Federation Force will probably be somewhere, you know, maybe it won't be, you know, mind-blowing experience, but there's no reason to expect it to be a bad game, and there's no reason to think Nintendo would let a bad game get out. For all the flack that Other M gets, and it gets a ton of flack, people need to remember that game basically rates in the sevens when it gets reviewed.
Yeah,
like,
it's an okay game. It's okay. Yeah. It has good parts. It's a big disappointment, for sure. And it makes you realize just how good and how polished
right.
the Prime
I mean,
series
the,
is.
There's no reason to expect that game will be of quality lesser than that, because you're dealing with known quantities. You're dealing with Nintendo, who's going to protect this brand, and you're dealing with a development studio with whom they have a lot of relationships and a lot of good history.
May I close out by reading an interview quote with Tanabe about the game that I think would fit in nicely?
Who wouldn't talk to us about the game?
Yes, please. I try.
Okay. Yeah, this was Stephen Totillo at Kotaku. So Totillo asks, I see what you're saying, but just to stay with this a bit longer, I think for a lot of people, it feels as if, for example, Mr. Miyamoto and Mr. Tezuka, they made Super Mario games, and people are used to Super Mario games. And imagine if there wasn't a new Super Mario game for 8 years or for however long it's been. For the next Mario game to be, say, Mario Tennis, people would say, aren't you still making Mario side-scrollers? Aren't you still making the 3D Mario games? And that's what I'm hearing from a lot of my own readers. They say, this is interesting, but where is our Metroid? Where is our Samus Aran adventure? And I think that they're worried that Nintendo isn't interested in making that. Do you have anything you can say to those people? And his response, personally, I don't feel like I'm creating anything that's even close to a side story. Until now, we've never had a game focusing on the Federation Force fighting against the Space Pirates, though that's always been in-universe. So the main idea here is that I sort of wanted to change that focus a little bit and see it from a different point of view in the same universe. So as I briefly mentioned earlier, once you play the game, you'll be able to feel that Metroid Prime universe. So it's kind of, at this point, it's a little difficult, I'm sure, for both sides to get that idea. For players who haven't touched the game, it's really difficult to imagine that feeling when you touch the game. So it's kind of an unfortunate situation that it was announced at this time, but it's something I definitely look forward to having the users touch and play and experience the awesomeness of it.
The awesomeness. Yeah, well, I mean, that doesn't tell us very much about the game, certainly, but, you know, obviously he's confident. He takes it very seriously, and I'll just say, I think Kensuke Tanabe is a badass. I think he's one of the best people at Nintendo in Japan, and he not only directed Zelda A Link to the Past, but he produced Metroid Prime, Nintendo World Report's Game of the Decade for the first decade of this millennium, and he's now producing Federation Force. I'm pretty sure he's going to make sure that's a good game. I have a pretty damn high degree of confidence in that man, and frankly in Next Level Games, who are one of the best Western studios making games for any Nintendo platform. So I have very high hopes for it. I just don't know what the fuck it is yet, and I haven't gotten to try it myself, and I wish I had. I want to try it. I'm excited to try it. But obviously, yes, I hope they are also working on other Metroid games. I could say that no matter what it had been announced as. But with that, we are going to have to wrap up this episode. So please remember to send in your emails, especially if you have a quick short one for the Thunder Round. Send those in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'd really appreciate it, and we appreciate everybody who's been in writing in lately, and we hope we can get lots of questions onto the show. We like talking about those. Before we wrap up with, I guess we'll end on James's little thing here. So
my little thing. Well, do you want to do the plugs first?
Yeah, I was gonna. That's where I was going.
Okay.
So of course, before we go, I also want to thank Seren for being a great guest.
Oh, you're with welcome.
Too many games to talk about. Thank you so much for coming.
It's okay. Anytime.
And Seren, what would you? You really deserve a plug for all the great information that you brought today. And I heard that you just announced a brand new game that's coming to Wii U.
It is coming to Wii U. Am I allowed to mention other platforms?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay. Yeah, it's coming to Wii U, PC, PS3, PS4, PS Vita, Mac, Linux, and the other major console that I can't say by name for another 10 days.
Neo Geo Pocket Color.
Yep, Neo Geo Pocket Color. I got a lot of Ouya questions. A lot of questions about whether it was Ouya.
People still holding that torch for Ouya.
The system where every game can be pirated.
No, but what's it called and what is it?
It's called Monochrono, and it is a twin-stick black-and-white shooter with a time emphasis. So this is sort of the first time details are getting out, so I'll just say real quick, a gameplay session might go like you select your loadout with your main weapon, your special weapon, some items, some perks that you've purchased in the in-game store, and you go in and you have 5 or 10 seconds and there's just enemies all over the screen and you have to survive and complete a challenge in a huge rush. It's very, very frantic. You can hold down one of the triggers to slow down time and the clock once during the short time, and then you collect experience, coins, and then you use that towards the larger progression.
Cool. When roughly should we be looking for this game?
Late 2015, early 2016, full announcement within the next month and a half.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to it. So that's Monochrono coming out in a few months.
Maybe.
On your Wii U and other platforms of choice. Maybe. So good luck with that, Seren.
Thank you.
I'm sure that's quite a challenging project. But
One-woman team. Still rocking it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And of course, people can check out I've Got to Run. It's on both Wii U and on 3DS on the eShop.
The 3DS version is way better. I will say that because it's my own game.
There you go. All right, well, with that, just before we go, James has one more thing.
We do. So there's some retroactive changes going on. And one of the changes is we're going to make this thing more frequent. Not too frequent. We're still working on the timeline, but you know, retroactive, we had sort of let become this thing that happens when somebody remembers, oh shit, we do a segment called Retroactive, don't we? And we end up making, because we do them so infrequently, we made kind of a big production of them. And that led to us playing games like pretty much every game we played taking about 40 hours to get to the point where we want to do it. And that's sort of out of the spirit of what we used to do with Retroactive, where it was just like, I don't know, let's play this thing. It's on Virtual Console, it looks weird. And I want us, we're going to still do...
Those are back in the glory days of Virtual Console, to be fair.
We're still going to do retroactives that are big, questionable decision-making style retroactives. But I want to introduce small, questionable decision-making retroactives. We're going to call them Retroactive Juniors for the time being. That name probably won't stick, but...
Oh, I think it should.
In this case, we're going to announce our next retroactive game next week. And I say, why is it next week? Well, because I'm not picking it. You're not picking it. Nintendo's picking it for us. Whatever is the last Virtual Console game to release on either platform, at this point it would be Mario Tennis. It's the N64 Mario Tennis currently on the Wii U Virtual Console released today. But if they release some next week, it'll be that one.
We could do a lot worse than that one.
It'll be the most recent Virtual Console game they release as of next Thursday when we record this show. If they release multiple, well, then we're going to have to come down to a random selection, because ultimately this retroactive is up to fate.
Leave luck to heaven.
There you go. That is my almost certainly going to screw us plan for retroactive for the next one. We'll announce a date once we know what the game is. Because
Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
It's already out, so we're safe. Yes! Wall of Fire is already out, so it can't be that one.
Thank goodness.
But, you know, we'll announce a date based on what that game ends up being. If it's Mario Tennis, obviously it won't have to be too far out because that's not that big of a game. Right. If they go drop something huge on us and we're sitting here trying to figure out which version of Mega Man Star Force we're going to review, well, then we might have to push that time out a little bit. But we'll have all the details next week, so stay tuned to that and pray to God it's not something that's going to kill us.
You know, I'd really be afraid of the person at Nintendo who decides this stuff listening and trolling us if I thought that they actually ever heard a single episode.
If that person
of this
is
podcast.
Listening right now, you know what? You can give us a sign by dropping something really just monstrous on us and making us miserable. Because if I get in there and it's just something just complete, some kind of complete fuckery by Nintendo, then, well, I mean, I'm going to assume. And for the purposes of this conversation, Wii games released on the Wii U do count. But
oh,
I'm
really?
Not.
Okay, so if it's a Wii game on the eShop, that we'll call that an honorary virtual console.
Yeah, I'm not counting
on
it.
Which it kind of is.
But if it happens, then we'll count it.
Sin and Punishment is still supposed to come, quote, soon, unquote.
Boy, that would be a great day if that's what this ends up being.
I would be staring off into the abyss for like 20 minutes just trying to contemplate this bizarre reality in which we now live. But
all right, well, we'll see what it is next week.
Yep, we're basing this on the North American release calendar. If we have multiple games and not all of them are out in Europe, we will pick the ones that are available.
Okay.
We'll do what we can.
I'm excited to find out what it's going to be. So that'll be next week. And as it is, thanks everybody. We made a podcast and we're going to end it right now. So thanks everyone for listening. And thank you again to James, Guillaume, and Seren for being on the show this week.
Thank you.
We made a podcast.
We sure did.
We bought a zoo.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.